Storm system will move out of the central Rockies and into the Midwest tomorrow. As a result, showers and thunderstorms will spread across the region tomorrow and tomorrow night. Northern Midwestern states, including Wisconsin, will likely see heavy snow from this system. High temperatures today will range from the mid-20s across northern Wisconsin to near 60 degrees across southeastern Missouri and western Kentucky. Overnight low temperatures will range from around 10 degrees across northwestern Iowa to the low 40s across the Boot Heel of Missouri. The forecast for east central Illinois this afternoon, sunny and cooler with a high in the mid-40s. The wind from the northwest at 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tonight, becoming partly cloudy overnight, we'll see a low of 28. The wind will be light and out of the northeast. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy with a chance of afternoon showers and isolated thunderstorms. Look for a high in the upper 40s with the wind from the southeast at 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tomorrow night, showers and a chance of thunderstorms. The temperature will hold near steady in the upper 40s. The wind from the south at 10 to 15 miles per hour. Wednesday, mostly sunny, windy, and warm. Expect a high around 60. The wind will be out of the southwest at 25 to 30 miles per hour with gusts to 40. And the outlook for Wednesday night, mostly cloudy and colder with a low in the low 30s. At noon Central Time, temperatures across Illinois and Indiana ranged from the low 30s to the low 50s. Sunshine reported across both states. At Rockford, it was 32. At O'Hare, 34. Bloomington reported 38 degrees. In Mattoon, 43. In Carbondale, 53. South Bend checked in with 36 degrees. It was 42 at Lafayette, 51 at Indianapolis, and 47 at Terre Haute. Willard Airport reported a sunny sky at the top of the hour, 42 degrees, the dew point 20, the relative humidity 41%, the wind out of the west at 15 with gusts to 25 miles per hour, the barometric pressure 30.41 and rising, and at 12:39, 42 degrees in Urbana on the campus of the University of Illinois. Central Illinois has become a popular location for wind farms, with several facilities up and running and more proposed. Illinois Public Media's Jeff Bossert visited wind farms in Ford and Iroquois counties, and he spoke with residents, officials, and experts to learn why the region is such a draw for wind and if the benefits outweigh the concerns.
John and Diane Connor have farmed the same land near Sheldon in rural Iroquois County for 45 years. And since last spring, their property has been surrounded by wind turbines.
I said, it sounds like a jet airplane. Everybody laughs when I say that. And I said, no, it does. That's what it sounds like to me.
The Settlers Trail Wind Farm is the first development in the state for Chicago-based Eon Climate and Renewables. Diane says the company first started knocking on doors in their area about 5 years ago, offering contracts and more money than farmers could make off their land.
It sounds like it's a really good deal when you're looking at $8,000 income a year for just having a tower put up on your place.
The plan took shape as the Iroquois County Board approved a zoning ordinance to back the project. It allows turbines to locate 1,500 feet from homes, but the Connors were skeptical. Diane says she was concerned about what turbines would mean to the landscape and land value, and she had heard reports of noise pollution and shadow flicker through wind farms in northern Illinois. The Connors chose not to sign on, but their neighbors did. Once the turbines were in place, Diane says their fears became reality, with sounds resembling a jet airplane affecting their sleep at night.
It's my understanding that other counties that are considering the wind farms are using us as a basis to look at our mistakes and trying to rectify that before they do sign on with windmill companies.
The Connors' neighbors, Mark and Cindy Nagley, signed on to Settlers Trail. They don't have the same concerns about wind farms. They've been paid for the use of their property. But Mark Nagley agrees with John and Diane that setting up the turbines proved difficult for the whole area.
It's hard to stop being a farmer and look at it from a construction phase because they're into it to get their project done, and we're thinking they shouldn't be anywhere. They shouldn't be out there, but that's what they have to do to get the job done.
In order for renewable energy companies to locate in rural areas, Construction crews hired by the developer often have to grade and level the road with earth-moving equipment and add surfacing that will let companies bring in heavy cranes used to haul wind turbines. But both couples say gravel roads near their property have been reduced to washboard, with wavy patterns in the surface causing speed bumps and puddles when it rains. Mark Nagley.
It's like anything else. If you don't start with a smooth surface, then anything that you put on top of it just conforms to the roughness of what's underneath.
Matt Tulis is a spokesman for E.ON, who says it's working with a local road commissioner. And he admits setting up wind farms will cause disruption to landowners' property.
Whether it's debris in the field, if we've broken some of the drainage tiles, you know, if there's dirt that needs to be reclaimed, you know, we've been working with the landowners on an individual basis and trying to address whatever concerns they have.
Ron Schrader chairs the Iroquois County Board. He's heard from Sheldon residents that experience shadow flicker and other problems with nearby turbines, but Schrader says the county needs a tax benefit from somewhere in today's economy.
We need some income, and we can't get income by your taxes will just keep getting raised, and there's no jobs and no tax base. If you drive from just Crescent City to Watseka, Burns Implement is gone, and they had a lot of employees that made good wages. Lifetime Doors is gone. There's nothing to keep our young people in the county. There's not that many good jobs.
E.ON Climate and Renewables also has a wind farm in nearby Paxton in Ford County. Many of its turbines are visible from I-57. The superintendent at Paxton Buckley Lotus Schools calls the Pioneer Trail Wind Farm the district's most reliable source of revenue. Cliff McClure says he expects the district to receive $1.1 to $1.3 million in assessed taxes over 2 years, beginning in the summer of 2013. But he says at this point, they're not targeted for special projects.
Save for tomorrow, you know, and look at what some of those needs are, some of those things. But we've talked about some different repairs of buildings and some of the things that we could do instructionally. So, yeah, we've talked about those things, but no, that money's not earmarked as of this time.
Like E.ON's other wind farm near Sheldon, this one required a zoning ordinance. But in Ford County, it's also become an election issue.
There are quite a few new candidates now that are going to run, basically because they're concerned on the wind farms.
Ford County Board Member Tom McQuinn has turbines bordering his property, and to this point says he can't complain about the job E.ON Climate and Renewables did or the tax income it's bringing. But like Schrader, he admits there are concerns over a turbine's distance from someone's home.
That is an area that I still think could be looked at, readdressed, because I do agree that if you're a non-participating person, you really shouldn't have one right up next to you, especially considering that the windmill farms have all pretty well said that it can arrange these in a way to not really affect non-participating people.
Ford County Board candidate Cindy Erke says local officials failed to take into account concerns of health, safety, and property value when looking at wind developments.
Well, I want to thank everyone for coming tonight. Mayor Flessner, thank you very much for giving me the opportunity for this meeting.
Last November, those on each side of the issue spoke at a hearing in the Ford County community of Roberts, where BP wants to set up a wind farm. And Cindy says many times these projects are approved before residents are made aware of them.
After they learn all about it and they are say, gung-ho, great, I want to live amongst them, I want to participate in this, that's wonderful. And if they say, I've just learned all this information and what am I going to do with this? I'm not happy with this decision. Then they need to take steps to remedy the situation.
Erke and fellow county board candidate Ann Erke, who's also her mother-in-law, head up the group Energize Illinois, which contends that wind power is not a reliable resource. But wind power supporters say East Central Illinois lies in the sweet spot of the state's wind corridor. David Loomis is director of the Center for Renewable Energy at Illinois State University. He says counties like Iroquois, Ford, and Champaign also possess the proper transmission capacity to use the power generated.
And the third thing you need is a good market to sell it into. And so we have a big load center in Chicago. We've had a renewable portfolio standard in the state that's mandated that Ameren and ComEd buy an ever-increasing amount of their electricity from renewable resources.
Loomis says perhaps the biggest issue faced by local officials now is what it will cost to tear down the large turbines at the end of their expected lifetime, or if a company goes out of business before that.
What kind of surety do we have? What form does that take? Is that a letter of credit, an escrow account? When does that money have to be deposited? And how much is it going to cost? And that's a difficult question to say with great certainty, because we're looking at, you know, 20 to 30 years later.
Opponents of wind energy can be expected to continue their fight as proposals for new projects come before local officials. But inaction in Congress could discourage developers from making proposals. The recent extension of a payroll tax cut by Congress failed to extend a wind energy tax credit beyond this year, something experts say will keep developers from making proposals and costing jobs. But Luma says it's possible the credit could be extended during the lame duck session of Congress after November's election. I'm Jeff Bossert, Illinois Public Media.
An in-depth interview with David Loomis, as well as photos and video from area wind farms, can be found at our website, will.illinois.edu. General Motors made a record profit last year. To date, taxpayers have recovered close to half of their $50 billion investment in the company. So the bailout worked, right? Wrong, say Republican presidential candidates who insist the bailout was a huge mistake. Michigan Radio's Tracy Samilton has more.
Today, Bruce Haddon's looking forward to cashing a $7,000 bonus check from General Motors. Let's flash back, though, to late 2008. GM was broke. Banks had shut off the lending pipeline. Without a federal bailout, it was almost certain the company would have to shut its doors. Forever.
Well, I know it scared the heck out of me.
Haddon says he wouldn't have just lost his job if GM shut down. The federal government would have taken over his pension and cut it.
So I was wondering how I was going to make it.
GM's plight also scared the heck out of a lot of other people. Rebecca Lindland is an analyst with IHS Automotive. She says there was overwhelming agreement in the industry. A bailout was the only viable option.
Because otherwise we were looking at a free fall.
At least a million jobs lost, predicted the Center for Automotive Research. The ripple effect from GM's collapse would have been enormous. 3.5 years later, Rick Santorum got cheers in Michigan by suggesting the auto industry would have gotten along just fine without GM.
Capitalism works. Markets work.
Mitt Romney, son of former American Motors CEO George Romney, criticized President Barack Obama's handling of the bailout.
Instead of going through the normal managed bankruptcy process, he made sure the bankruptcy process ended up with the UAW taking the lion's share of the equity in the business.
Actually, the U.S. Treasury got most of GM's equity. And here's candidate Newt Gingrich campaigning in Tulsa.
Now, let me start with a simple premise that most Oklahomans will understand. You cannot put a gun rack in a vault.
President George W. Bush recently said the bailout prevented massive unemployment and insists he'd do it again. Auto consultant Jim Hall heads a firm called 2953 Analytics. He says GM has to be careful how it defends itself.
How seriously do you argue with crazy people?
There are plenty of people who are far from crazy who figure the criticism of GM is to be expected. The company went bankrupt. Now its corporate image is being batted around like a cat toy. But Hall says the attacks affect more than just GM.
You're hurting taxpayers. You're also hurting anybody that owns a GM share. And you're hurting the government's chance of getting its cash out of GM.
Unfortunately for the automaker,
GM's a company that people love to hate.
People aren't just mad about the bailout, says IHS Automotive analyst Rebecca Lindland. She thinks customers had been losing faith in GM's cars for a long time. So GM has to resurrect its image, not just defend it.
There's been a lot of talk about the Chevy Volt lately. How about some facts?
That's a new online ad GM is running to defend the Volt. Selim Bingel is GM's vice president of communications. He stresses the company's appreciation for the bailout.
The people at GM are eternally grateful for the help that we got and are really proud about the progress we're making and really want the citizens of the U.S. and Canada to know that it was a good thing they did.
He figures the controversy will continue until the presidential election in November. But given the passions awakened by the automotive bailout, that may be wishful thinking. For NPR News, I'm Tracy Samilton in Ann Arbor.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Monday. It's the 27th of February, 2012. It's the birthday of Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, Portland, Maine, 1807. Went off to Bowdoin College with Nathaniel Hawthorne. After the death of his wife, Mary Potter, from complications of a miscarriage, Longfellow found solace in reading German poetry and began writing poetry of his own. His first collection, Ballads and Other Poems, came out in 1841. It included The Wreck of the Hesperus and The Village Blacksmith, was very popular. 6 years later, Evangeline, then The Song of Hiawatha, then The Courtship of Miles Standish. And after the tragic death of his second wife, Fanny, in a fire, he translated Dante's Inferno. It was on this date, 1860, Abraham Lincoln gave a speech against slavery at Cooper Union in New York City. The Great Hall filled 1,500 New Yorkers curious to see this man from Illinois. One eyewitness said, "When he rose to speak, I was greatly disappointed. He was tall and so angular and awkward that I had for an instant a feeling of pity for so ungainly a man. But once Lincoln started to speak, quote, his face lighted up, the whole man was transfigured. I forgot his clothes, his personal appearance, his individual peculiarities. Forgetting myself, I was on my feet like the rest."